Welcome once again to our program, Reasons to Believe, or Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology. Our guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches history and religion at John Paul II Catholic High. I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church and present chaplain of John Paul II Catholic High. Ron, welcome once again. We're in that series where we're talking about how reason without the Bible or without revelation, which is God's greatest gift to us, can demonstrate the existence of God, a creator, a designer, a source from which all things come. And we're talking about, we got up to the scientific arguments about from existence of God from geology. Do you want to say anything about where we were last week, or just jump in right there?
Well, I'd like to make a few comments before I get into that. We've been talking about scientific arguments, you know, to prove God's existence, or at least make it reasonable to believe, you know, that God exists. And so far we've looked at evidence from cosmology, evidence from physics, evidence from astronomy, and we're getting ready to look at evidence in the field of geology. Now, I have to say, I'm not a scientist in any of these areas, nor do I know a whole lot about them. I've done a little bit of reading in the areas, but so I have to rely on, you know, the
authorities.
The authorities that I think are credible in these areas for the information that I get, and I hope that I interpreted correctly. I would stand corrected on anything where I didn't. But I've always had a deep appreciation of science, and when I was younger, in fact, I was very much interested in pursuing some kind of a probably biological science area career. But after I got out of the Air Force, I decided to go into the social science area. So I did have had a lot of training, of course, and have taught many years in the history and social science areas, particularly sociology, which was my minor when I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois for quite a few years. But my specialty at Illinois during those years, and most of the years after that on my own reading and writing and research, has been in the area of science, the history of science, and particularly its relationship to religion. So that's basically my background in this area.
Well, you're quoting very competent authorities from what I know about it.
Well, in the area of geology, it's a science that deals with the history of the Earth and its life, especially as recorded in the rocks. And it is a study of the solid matter of the Earth, or I understand also of the Moon. They include the Moon. Geologists have discovered that the Earth is much more than a large, solid, spinning rock. It has about an 8,000-mile diameter interior with a solid iron core surrounded by iron liquefied by extreme heat and pressure. Earth possesses many conditions that are necessary to sustain life. For one, the Earth has exactly the precise minimum mass required to create and maintain an atmosphere that freely exchanges the chemicals needed for life and to protect inhabitants from cosmic radiation. Again, I couldn't attest to these things myself because I'm not a scientist in this area, but I am relying upon people who say these things are true. For example, large-brained creatures like humans require an atmosphere that contains about 20% oxygen. Moreover, the Earth is the minimum size necessary to keep the heat from the interior from being lost too quickly. The radioactive decaying interior regulates the critically important mantle, that is, the outside of the Earth, the crust, the mantle convection inside the Earth. If it were just a little smaller, I understand, or larger, the Earth would cool down too quickly or slowly. What's more, if the Earth were much larger, surface gravity would fracture the mountains, and eventually the Earth would be a smooth sphere covered entirely with about 10,000 feet of water. Although water is necessary to sustain life, a water-covered planet would not possess tides and weathering required to wash the nutrients from the continents to feed organisms in the water. In addition, the salt concentrations in the ocean would be too high to sustain life because the tides, this is what I've read, the tides regulate the amount of salt in the oceans by depositing large quantities of salt along the coast. Furthermore, geologists have discovered that the Earth possesses large, solid tectonic plates that float on the Earth's mantle. The oceans lubricate and facilitate the movement of these plates. The drifting of these plates is necessary in the creation of land masses and mountains that keep the Earth's surface above sea level. This is where you have these fault lines, for example. The San Andreas Fault down in California or other faults.
San Francisco on the San Andreas Fault.
Tectonic plates come together. And I watch quite a bit, but my knowledge comes mostly of things of this sort from reading a little bit of more popularized type science or watching some of the programs on Discovery Channel or, the National Geographic or...
But what you're getting to is that there is such a balance required that there has to be someone or some creative intelligence that created this system of balance.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. We're describing at a bare minimal level and a popularized level of the complexity of the universe and the complexity in this particular case, geology of the Earth. And going back to the plate tectonics, I understand it drives the Earth's carbon dioxide rock cycle, which is critical in regulating the environment by balancing greenhouse gases and keeping the temperature of the planet at a level which is conducive to life. Because these conditions that are conducive to life are just very, very constricted, very precise. And this process is a complex one, acting like a thermostat that keeps greenhouse gases in balance and surface temperatures under control. I understand also that the plate tectonic system generates the planet's magnetic field, which is necessary to shield the Earth from dangerous radiation. And, in addition, the proportion of sunlight reflected by the Earth by polar ice caps, deserts, and continents help to regulate the Earth's temperature and climate. You think about our own lives. There's just a very, very small range of temperature, survivable, let alone comfortable. You think between, let's say, 65 and 85 degrees is, what most human beings would consider to be, a comfort range, I think. And for the most part, the Earth stays within those ranges, at least in the temperature.
So these are things that geologists who spend their lives studying these things tell us that, again, indicates a design to keep the balance.
Yeah, and there are many other phenomena that help to regulate the Earth's temperature and climate, such as ocean currents, making it habitable for life. But the point to remember is that it is reasonable to believe that life on Earth could be possible only with the existence of an omniscient, that is, an all-knowing and an omnipotent and all-powerful being who designed, created, and sustains it.
So would you agree or not that studying any of the things we're talking about, physics, geology, our astronomy, the other things we've talked about, could and should lead a person to a magnificent wonder of the power of the Creator?
Yes, this goes back to that argument that we gave earlier, just the experiential argument, just the us experiencing wonder,
okay,
should be enough, or at least has led people to believe that there has to be something, behind all of this. I tell my students, for example, when you take a class in science, yes, there's a scientific method and a scientific way of explaining it, and that's fine. The church would say that's the way it should be done. Don't mix theology and, science.
Well, one of the children had this story from the grade school. They were having a little session in science, And at the end, one of the kids, I think it was in the second grade, just automatically said, "Oh, Miss Clark, isn't God wonderful to be able to create things like that?" And they immediately, with a child's sense of intuition, connected the creation with the Creator.
Yeah, I think a class in science, all it does is tell us how God did it, from a scientific point of view.
Sure.
And
how complicated it is.
And there are some good textbooks, of course, that are used in Christian courses. And at John Paul, we use some of these textbooks in our science class. I mean, we teach regular biology. Yet at the same time, we also point out, that there is a designer behind all of this and a creator, a cause of all of this. But we keep the, when we talk about the scientific aspects of biology, we talk about, we do the same thing we do in the public schools.
Sure.
Take mathematics or physics, a class in physics. All I think you're really doing there is quantifying God's creation, the way he did things. You're just simply putting it into mathematical terms, which shows, again, the precision and the extreme complexity, but yet still man has the ability to be able to understand this and even put it into mathematical terms.
Okay, I think that's one of the advantages of a school like John Paul II Catholic High, that references can be made not only to what is scientific facts, but that God is behind it all, and not substituting science for religion, or religion for science.
Yes, okay. The church has always insisted that they're two separate fields, it should be kept that way, yet at the same time, there are, when you get into the matters of causation and things of that sort from an ultimate point of view, then you're getting over into the realm of philosophy, getting over into the realm of theology or religion.
I think it was our famous American essayist Emerson who said, "What I have seen teaches me to trust the Creator that I have not seen." So we're always going to the source, always going to the source. Okay. Let's talk about biochemistry being a way that great biochemists have come to a knowledge of a creator or a designer.
Biochemistry deals with the study of chemical compounds and processes occurring in organisms. And evolution scientists claim that complex organisms have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications over many generations. Moreover, they claim that these modifications were caused by impersonal blind forces or mutations and natural selection. There are a growing number of biochemists who have made discoveries that challenge the evolutionary hypothesis. For example, Michael Behe, who I mentioned earlier, has demonstrated that complicated microscopic organisms such as cilia and bacterial flagella are extremely unlikely to have been built in a piece-by-piece manner because they had to be fully present in order to function. In other words, they just simply couldn't, develop by stages. Other examples include the extremely complex system of transporting proteins within cells and the intricate process of blood clotting. And people like Behe or Dembski give many, 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 many other examples, of course, when you read, their books. But nonetheless, he and other prominent biochemists believe that the complexity of these types of organisms point to a, quote, purposeful, intentional design by intelligent agent, end of quote. Now, to the contrary, some argue that evolution explains everything without a divine designer. And Peter Kreeft says that just the opposite is true. He tells us that evolution is a beautiful example of design. In other words, basically, he's accepting the evolution as a hypothesis that, it has been proven. Even the Pope John Paul II went so far as to accepting it as a hypothesis, that there's a lot of evidence that has, been developed over the centuries.
A reasonable hypothesis.
Yes, a reasonable hypothesis. even used the term more than a hypothesis, John Paul, which he really fell under a great deal. But if we do put on this series dealing with the theory of evolution and intelligent design, we'll go into that issue rather than trying to do that right now. But nonetheless, Kreef tells us that evolution is a beautiful example of design, a great clue to God. There's very good scientific evidence for the evolving ordered appearance of species from simple to complex ones, he says. He says that there is no scientific proof of a natural selection as the mechanism of evolution, though. He doesn't accept that part of evolution. Natural selection explains the emergence of higher forms without intelligent design by the survival of the fittest principle. But he dismisses that as sheer theory without a shred of scientific proof that this idea of the survival of the fittest and natural selection is just pure blind chance.
So there are many competent scientists in biochemistry who argue very strongly for intelligent design behind all this complexity.
Yes, if you accept the theory of evolution, you say, well, that's the way God did it. And the church, I think, basically is essentially always accepted that view, that's the way God did it.
Okay.
And these are what we would call secondary causes.
Okay.
And as I said, I don't want to get into that now, because if we do have that series, we'll talk about things like secondary causes.
All right. In our progress towards trying to use scientific statements by competent people to show the existence of God or a creator or a divine designer, what about biological information?
Well, biological information is a study of any of various nucleic acids that are usually the molecular basis of heredity, are localized especially in cell nuclei, and are constructed on a double helix held together by hydrogen bonds. And scientists have discovered that within every one of our 100 trillion cells is a 6-foot DNA coil containing a 4-letter chemical alphabet that spells out precise assembly instructions for all of the proteins from which our bodies are made. A prominent scientist claims that no hypothesis had been proposed that even comes close to explaining how our information got into biological matter by any naturalistic explanation or any naturalistic means. That the complexity of information systems point to design by some superintelligence. Another thing they point out is that millions of years ago, many new life forms appeared on Earth almost overnight. And this phenomenon is called the Cambrian explosion, a time when new life forms suddenly appeared fully formed in the fossil record with no prior transitions. The explosion of new life forms would have required the infusion of massive amounts of new biological information. And scientists tell us that information is the product of intelligence. One can conclude from this fact that, quote, from the evidence of genetics and biology, we can infer the existence of a mind that's far greater than our own, a conscious, purposeful, rational, intelligent designer who's amazingly creative, end of quote.
Amazingly creative, awesomely creative, created beyond our wildest imaginations. Okay, how about, let's switch a little bit to the evidence of psychology or the evidence of consciousness. What do competent authorities say about this as a scientific argument for the existence of a designer, a creator, or whom we call God?
Well, I'll start this one out by saying that Catholics believe that God created man in his image and likeness. And by image, we mean that man has an eternal soul with the faculties of intellect, free will, imagination, and memory. The soul contains our consciousness. Like God, we have the ability to reflect on our own existence. Another way of putting it is that man has consciousness or awareness of his own person. You can kind of, so to speak, step outside yourself and see yourself. Now, we may not see ourselves, the way we really are, but to the extent that we do, then, you know, that's reality. Each man possesses a pattern of reflexive attitudes toward his own person that social psychologists call the self. Moreover, the soul forms the body and gives it life. And death is the separation of the soul from the body. The body is created in accordance with the laws of nature established by God at the beginning. But he creates the soul from nothing at the moment of conception. And for decades, psychologists, social scientists, and other scientists have tried to convince us that consciousness, because this is what we're talking about, consciousness is merely a physiological process. It's nothing more than a function of the brain. However, today many scientists are telling us that the laws of chemistry and physics cannot adequately explain our experience of consciousness.
So it seems that more and more competent scientists in many branches of science are coming to say, well, we have to move into some kind of intelligent designer. Now, they all don't do that, but there's enough competent people that would make us stand up and listen.
Yes, let me define consciousness here, see if that helps us. It's been defined as our, quote, our introspection, sensations, thoughts, emotions, desires, beliefs, and free choices that make us alive and aware, end of quote. One researcher has shown that consciousness can continue after a person's brain has stopped functioning, and others have found that the soul is a separate entity from the brain. At the philosophical or the metaphysical level, the question is, quote, how do we get something from nothing? How could consciousness come from inanimate matter? If the universe began with lifeless matter having no awareness of itself, quote, how then do we get conscious creatures who live, think, feel, and believe from lifeless materials? Even some unbelieving scientists admit that there must be a supernatural origin of the self-conscious mind or soul. Christians believe that it is reasonable to believe that the origins of human consciousness is the omnipotent, the omniscient mind of God, the all-knowing mind of God.
One of the first things children learn at St. Patrick's School is that we are composed of body and soul. Our body is corruptible and our soul is incorruptible. Our body is mortal and our soul is immortal. And that's a very good place to begin.
Well, that's the reason I began there, because that's the Catholic position, you know, and I think the true position. That the soul is that which gives life, forms the body and gives it life, and that's where our consciousness is located. It's in our soul.
In our soul.
But on the other hand, if you think that if you're a materialist, and some scientists are materialists, and you think that the consciousness is nothing more than a function of the brain, and then when the brain dies, then when the person dies and the brain dies, of course, then the soul dies with it. We're going to come back to that issue a little bit later on when we talk about proofs for the existence of the soul and the spirituality of the soul. Let me quote Father Aidan Nichols here, who we've quoted several times on this matter. One of the world's greatest contemporary theologians. He sheds, a great deal of light on this subject, worth considering. Of human consciousness, he says, how could the design that obviously exists now in man and in the human brain come from something with less or no design? He says this violates the principle of causality, which states that you can't get more in the effect than you have in the cause. That's an old, that's a philosophical principle, a logical principle. If there is intelligence in the effect, that is man, there must be intelligence in the cause. However, a universe ruled by blind chance has no intelligence. He concludes that there must be a cause for human intelligence that transcends, or that is above or beyond the universe, or greater than the universe, a mind behind the physical universe. This great mind is God. In this regard, he points out that most great scientists over the centuries have believed in such a mind, such an intellect, such a great intellect. Even those who did not believe in any revealed religion.
Okay. A person who delved into the complexity of the physical universe, even though they didn't believe in the Bible, still came, many of them came to the conclusion there has to be a super intelligence guiding and forming all these complexities in scientific discovery.
Yes, there has to be a designer and there has to be a cause to put it into motion and to keep it into motion.
Okay, could we kind of come to the conclusion of our program with evidence that proves God's existence?
Well, we'll quote Father Nichols again here. He's extremely helpful in answering this question. He says that a number of individually less than convincing arguments taken together may make a convincing case for God's existence. He points out that this is John Henry Newman's strategy in his essay, Aid of a Grammar of Consent, published during the First Vatican Council in 1870. He says that Newman offered a new context in which to display the various argumentative strategies in the strata of experience that are relevant to belief in God. He says that in the Grammar of Assent, Newman further refined this idea in relation to the basic tenets of Christian theism, calling such a manner of arriving at certitude about something or someone the illative sense. When we were talking about in the series on the Nicene Creed, we talked quite a bit about this illative sense, that any one argument for the proof of God's existence is probably not sufficient. But when you have many, that's why we've spent so much time giving so many of these arguments. But when you put them all together, it's just absolutely an overwhelming, proof for God's existence. To illustrate this point, Father Nichols uses the example of a jigsaw puzzle in which one spreads out the pieces on a table looking like an accidental collection of bits and pieces that tell us absolutely nothing. When we piece these together, they form a picture. And in this regard, Father Nichols tells us that Newman's suggestion is that we can defend belief in God by putting together a number of experiential, here's the word experiential signals and lines of thought, which converge on the conclusion that there is a God. And he concludes that while none of these arguments taken singly might be wholly compelling, taken cumulatively, they amount to a very strong case.
Okay, our time again has run out on us. And we'd like to thank our listeners. May God bless you always and in all ways.